Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James, and this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. And today my co-host is a New York Times bestselling author of high action adventure and techno thrillers. He's been a guest on the show in the past, and I am honored to have him here with me today. And Grant Blackwood, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again, Stephen. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I still remember the day when we shot those M4s at that training training compound down in near Phoenix.
That's right.
Man, a couple years ago. Those were good times.
They were good times. And for those of you who don't know how meticulous Stephen is, we were on a range, and Stephen was taking a lot of notes for research. He was the only guy with a steno pad in his holster instead of a weapon. So,
yeah, a steno pad in one hand and an M4
in
the other. You know, just get out of the way. So, but anyway, thanks so much for being on. And I remember when I interviewed last time, you had this great image that I still remember, the face mask that you talked about. So we may jump in, and I may have you review that, because that was really good, helpful info. And so for today, our guest has the heart of a nomad. She has traveled widely, and with a passion of a bard, she has also been sharing her stories through her critically acclaimed fiction as she moves, you know, from place to place and falls in love with each place and lets it take up home in her heart. Jamie Mason's pulse-pounding prose and atmospheric settings have received wide critical acclaim. Monday's Lie is a thriller that delivers more of the Hitchcockian menace that Peter Straub says. And Three Graves Full was a critical hit, and for fans of the Coen brothers and Gillian Flynn, the new book, Monday's Lie, is a book you don't want to miss. So, Jamie, it's great to have you here with us today.
Well, thank you. I like the intro. I think we should just stop there. That was awesome.
It's like sometimes when I go speak, like someone will introduce you, and you never know what they're going to say, right? And so sometimes I was at this one event, and they're like, "Oh, Steve is so funny. You're going to laugh so." And I was like, "I'm not doing comedy today. I'm like teach. You'll be so funny." I'm like, "Oh, no, don't do that." So sometimes I'll get up and I'll say, "That is the kindest introduction I have ever written." People always laugh.
Right, exactly.
Ever written, you know, so. They kind of get it. Okay, you know.
That's good.
Well,
Jamie,
thank you
for having me. This is fun.
Yeah. I think our paths first crossed over at Killer Nashville a couple years ago. And don't you remember that there was this one publisher who said, "Let's all go out for steak." And they invited us, and we're like, "Well, okay, we don't write for your publisher, but fantastic, you know, if you want to buy us a steak." And I don't remember the name of that place, the Stockyard or somewhere.
Oh, yes, the Stockyard.
You remember that, right?
That was memorable.
Maybe 8 or 10 of us, and this one publisher, like I say, we have nothing against the publisher, but we've never written for the publisher.
No.
Start ordering steaks, and Grant, the cheapest steak on the menu was $90.
Yep.
Well,
there was no dollar sign. No, it was the size of a deck of cards, and it was $89, but they didn't have a dollar sign. So I'm looking down the menu, going, "Dear God, tell me that's not in dollars," because it was a very fancy menu, and it said $89, and I was like, "No, come on, that can't be." So I went $10 up at that point. What difference does it make? And I got $99 fillet that was smaller than a hockey puck. But, I mean, we were well fed by the end of it. It was not a problem.
It was
shocking.
Yeah, it was, and honestly, I was sitting there like, okay, they invited us. And there was this moment where I'm about to order, and I'm like, "I'm not having to pay for this, am I?" Like, you know, I'm like thinking in my brain, "What am I going to do? Like, do I say, by the way, you are paying for?" I was just like, all right.
Do you remember the guy who
paid for this? I'm ordering $100 steak.
Do you guys remember the guy? So the Stockyard is done in these narrow rooms. And do you remember the guy who came in and sang, it's Nashville, so everybody's
trying to get
their foot in the door. And the guy comes in and sings, and he really was terrific. But the problem is you're in a room about the size of a boxcar, and he's using his soulful rock and roll face 4 feet from you, and it's super awkward, and I wanted to run away.
I remember that, and you called it his rock star face. I still remember, right. Yeah.
It was really itchy.
That is funny. So, you know, when people tell stories, or I'll just say sing or whatever, context is huge. Like, a lot of people don't really always take that into consideration, like how close you are to the people you're, you know, speaking to or singing to. And like, it would have been fine if he were on, you know, a national stage and, you know, we were out in the audience. But, you know, like you say, he's 3 feet away and you're like, what are you doing? So.
Dial it down, man. Dial it down.
Well, for me, that's just a symptom of getting older. You know, I'm always asking, does it really have to be this loud in here? I can't even hear myself think. So I think those kind of lines started coming to me when I turned 50 really easily. So.
Well,
I've always been old then. I have always been old.
Jamie, when I was looking at some of your writing in your books, I mean, I mentioned this off the air just before we got on, but I'm really struck by the voice, your storytelling voice. And, I mean, voice is something that is kind of hard to really, I guess, define or capture. I kind of think of it as the sort of the distinctiveness of each author and the authenticity of the characters, kind of like that. But I love the witty, kind of unique voice that you have. And when I went to the Nashville Film Festival a couple weeks ago to meet with some producers and writers, just to see if there was some interest in one of my projects in Hollywood. And just listening in some of the seminars to the screenwriters talk, this is what I came away with. Voice gets you a seat at the table. Passion gets you heard. Story gets you a career. Now, that's just me, you know, and I mean trying to distill down what I was hearing. But voice gets you a seat at the table. Like if you send in a screenplay or whatever it is, if they see something very unique in your voice, they'll say, I want to, you know, at least talk to this person or something. And then the passion gets your pitch heard or whatever. But to build a career, obviously, we need to tell great stories. So thinking about that, the idea of pitch is kind of what gets us a seat at the table, or I mean voice, and just how strong I think your voice is. Well, when you write, are you conscious of that? Are you just trying to enter the mindset of the narrator or the perspective of the person writing? Or what's going through your mind when you kind of dive into a character like that?
It's kind of funny that you brought this up, because just yesterday I was having this conversation with some writers, and I think it's a natural byproduct of how you actually work, and you certainly can be aware of it and write towards it or away from it as you need to. But one of the things that I never thought of that influenced voice so much, and thank you for saying I'm good at it, is that some writers are very visual. They are seeing, and maybe just some people are very visual, they're seeing it almost play out like a movie. I do not do this. I have watercolor images for the most part at best, and sometimes just non-visual concepts whatsoever. So I'm kind of twice removed. And what I'm thinking is, the person in this situation, what are they likely to be thinking about? What are they likely to be feeling or seeing? And because I'm not doing it visually, I'm doing it that ended up being kind of unusual in the company I was in. I realized that my word choice is so deliberate because I'm not seeing it. And I just got a wonderful letter from someone talking about how absolutely repulsive a scene that I wrote was. And it was a very funny letter because she liked the book. She said it actually made her sick. And I found this really funny because she saw it, but I didn't. And I think the voice came in because I have to try to I have to construct to, it was all about words for me, not about the picture. And I think that is one element of why the voice comes out the way it does. And I am aware of it. I love the words. The words, I love story, but the words are the stuff that make me just enjoy sitting down to work. That's the part of the work I love. So the first draft is kind of white knuckling it for me, and then when I get to really just pay attention to the language, and I guess that's why it happens. But I think kind of where everybody, what's going on in their head, the writer's head, is probably where the voice comes from, how they're managing words.
I'm fascinated by your watercolor imagery. Was it always that way for you? Has the imagery always been something impressionist-like when you're writing? Has it always been that
way? It has always been that way, and it's really funny because you'll get people asking you, well, who did you see in your mind when you wrote such and such a character?
Right.
And I can't answer them. In fact, it's really funny. I don't, and this is not common in writers. I often don't really know what my characters look like. I'm no more aware of what they look like than I'm aware of what I look like right at this minute because I'm on the inside looking out. So I have an impression of what they look like. I know their general physical description, but I don't see them that way. Unless there's something specifically important about the way they look, I don't. And it's funny to me that some people see them very strongly, and I love that because what I'd like to think is exactly that, is it's an impression, and they've been able to put themselves or somebody that they think suits. So I love it the best when people come and tell me who they think would play so-and-so in the adaptation, and I think that's great. Although I did have, in Monday's Lie, the only sharply visual character I've probably ever written. There's a character named Brian. He's one of the main characters. And for some reason, he looked like Clive Owen to me, and that was kind of nice. Worse things have happened to look like Clive Owen.
So, Grant, I forget, actually, how many novels you've written, Grant. But how many is it?
Written or published?
Oh, let's say published.
I guess I'm at 14 or 15, probably.
Okay, so... So in 14 or 15 books, just this idea of voice is interesting to me. Like, are there any of those books where you look back and you're like, you know, well, there was this one character who really was super distinctive and still kind of resonates in my mind even after all of these stories?
Well, yeah, I think, of course, protagonists tend to do that. But, you know, there was one character from my Briggs Tanner series, the first... The End of Enemies, and he was a Navy SEAL named Bob Jurens, and he was called Scunny Bob Jurens, his self-proclaimed only black dairy farmer in Wisconsin. And he kind of just took off, and he became this entity that people asked about. And, you know, initially, he was just going to be kind of a bit character, and he got to be bigger. So it happens, but I try to be careful about letting that happen too much because I'm kind of a stickler for roles in my book.
You know, what's kind of tricky about that made me laugh hearing Grant say that is that I got stuck writing a character and she ends up being one of the most delightful things I've ever done, but I realized that she's actually smarter than I am, and that's tricky. Go try to invent somebody who's smarter than you. And make her sound right.
Well, actually, I think every character I've ever had to do has had to be smarter than me.
Yeah,
but they can't be, right? They can't. But at the bottom line is they really
right
can't
there.
Be.
What did you say, Greg?
Well, she just described my entire writing life, and I'd
know,
like
exactly
to get that out of my brain right now. Thank you.
Sometimes for me, I'll think of a line, and that line will sort of just capture a lot of essence of a character. I was just thinking of when we were talking about this, like there's this one character, Ralph. He's kind of this big, he's an ex-ranger. He's real tough, right? And he's in these books, but he's kind of like a teddy bear. He's soft at heart when you get to know him. And there's this one scene where someone said something about being afraid, and he goes, "I eat the smell of fear for breakfast." And they're like, that doesn't even make sense. But I just love this line, like, I eat the smell of fear for breakfast. And it's
I
like,
don't even need the food. I just need the smell of it. That's all I require.
I eat the smell of – so I actually had these bumper stickers made up that say, I eat the smell of fear for breakfast.
Oh, God.
And at my book signings, we were giving them away to people. And so you'll see people around my city driving around this thing on the back of their car.
Oh, wow. That's
yeah,
great.
It was kind of fun. Yeah.
I love it.
So – Jamie, I think it's interesting, too, how you mentioned earlier that for you, it's so much about the words.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that and this is just my view, I guess, but I think that some writers tend to be naturally gifted storytellers, and the stories come easily for them, but the words are tougher. And then others are naturally gifted wordsmiths, where the words come easily, but maybe it's tougher to find to uncover the story. And
thank
it sounds
you for
like
naming
what you
my
said,
pain
is that you have that, but you know that gift of the words and speaking the words, but maybe figuring out the story is more of a challenge.
Oh, definitely, and it's so exciting when I know what to do. I think that privacy. I work out of my home, and everybody goes to work and school, and so I'm alone, and that's great because I'm a crazy person. I walk through my house because I don't know what happens next, or I don't know. I've written myself into a little corner, and I'm trying to see it and figure out what have I done. And so I'm walking laps of my house, and I'll figure it out and go flying back to the office. But yeah, that for me, and it's really interesting to talk to people because you're right, it does seem to be one way or the other. Some people claim to have no problem in either one, and either they're delusional or extremely lucky. But yeah, that's the story part. It's very relieving when I've put these people in a predicament, and I have a reasonable enough time putting them in a predicament, but threading it through and making it complex is really the scary part for me. I'm not intimidated by language at all because that's where I love, that's my love. So we talked about this a little off air. There is a danger there because because I'm writing crime fiction and suspense, I end up with a kind of a weird sound. It sounds weird in people's heads, and you have to be able to be okay with people not responding to it. Some people really, I think story trumps everything, and I do think that's true. And you have to know where you are in relation to that conclusion.
So when you're walking these laps through your house, and you feel like you're in some sort of corner or whatever, sort of a narrative dead end. What are the steps that you take to uncover what lies around the next bend? Do you ask yourself certain questions? Do you review the story? Do you reread what you've written? Because I have the sense that a lot of people go through the same process, really. I mean, we write, we're excited, we're enthused, we get to a spot and we're like, man, I just don't know what should come next.
I do all of those things, but the other thing that I do is, those pictures that sort of what do they call them? It's a picture puzzle. It's a perception puzzle where you're basically looking at a field of almost static or dots, and you have to relax your eyeballs, right? To have the picture jump out. There's a mental version of that, and I have to kind of fuzz out, and stuff just starts flowing. Unrelated stuff. It's sort of a weird place in consciousness, I guess, where you're not herding cats and you're not sorting them. And sometimes that helps. But, yes, of course, reading back through and thinking about the characters and asking myself, there's two questions. Either what would this person do in this situation, or what would a person be like if they were the kind of person that would end up having this befall them? And so those are kind of the two opposite ones. But then after that, it is about kind of just fuzzing out the focus. And that's a very schizophrenic, bizarre moment to ride through, but I guess I have lots of practice at this point.
I have to tell you, Jamie, I'm like you, and it's kind of heartening to hear you say it. For me, I realize that I'm thinking too much. I'm thinking too hard about a subject, and I have to do that fuzzing out, as you called it, to put my brain in the right place.
What's a great way to do it?
How's that? Walk your house. Walk through your house.
Whiskey.
I have a strong emergency measure. I'm kind of like a cat. I don't like to be wet. I don't like to be immersed in water. So I have this torture that I do. That if I'm really stuck, I make an extremely strong drink and I get into an extremely hot bath, and I'm either going to sort it out or drown.
Wow.
And that seems to do. I have 100% success rate so far.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask how many times, you failed in that, but this idea of, I was trying to think. I heard this guy who was an expert in creativity, and he was talking about, I can't remember which painter. Gosh, I'll probably think of it in a minute. But anyway, this painter would lay in bed and hold, I don't know, a bell or a ball or something in his hand. And then when he fell asleep, it would fall to the floor, and that would then awaken him. And then he would lay in that. So he understood that there are different states of consciousness, sort of. Like when we focus on something, you know, we're kind of using one part of our brain. When we're asleep, another. But sort of they call it like the alpha waves or something. Like most creative work is often done when we're in some sort of like a trance-like state. I mean, it sounds weird, but there are different mental states we're in, right? And so, but he would lay there and then kind of in this emerging half asleep, half awake, then he would think about his work in that moment before going back to it. And I mean, truthfully, when I'm in, you know, in a certain place as I'm working on a book, maybe under deadline, I've been working on it all day, and I just listen to trance music, like electronica music, whatever. And it is almost like you get into this different mental place, and you just, you move through the story, and you don't, you know, overanalyzing it can cause you to stumble, and it's just, yeah.
It's a lot like thinking about how you tie your shoes. If you think too hard about how you tie shoes, it gets a lot harder.
Oh, now, thanks. I'll never be able to tie my shoes again, Grant. Appreciate that.
You are welcome.
Well, you know, and you also have to think that that might be one of the peculiarities about creative people, because we have to be comfortable in that state, or at least have some degree of willingness to go there, because what we're doing, I mean, the three of us write fiction, so we are dedicating a lot of energy and thought to something that not only never happened, it's never going to happen. These people don't exist. This scenario doesn't exist. I mean, it may or may not be. I mean, what the three of us write is reflective of a world very similar to ours. But you have to be comfortable treating this seriously, taking it seriously, and going into these weird states to be able to do justice to something that is never going to happen. And it's kind of funny that I think the comfort level with that is one of the distinctions that I see between people who do this and people who don't.
There's a certain uncertainty about it all that you have to be comfortable with. The grayness of kind of stepping into, well, the whiteness of the blank page, that if you're not comfortable with that uncertainty of what comes next, it's going to be very difficult for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think trust is a huge key to really any artistic endeavor, but especially for us. I mean, when we're going to embark on a book, it might be 400, 500, 600 pages. It might be 1,000, 1,500 hours of work, you know, and it's like to trust that, you know, the ideas will come, that it isn't just like, you know, you might start with a premise or an elevator pitch or, you know, theme or something like that, but you're trusting that the characters that you need will emerge, that the story that you need to tell will unfold. And if you want to go into it without trusting the art form, you're not going to get very far.
And that is that for me personally, that is the, and it almost seems silly to call it terrifying, because there's different levels of terror, obviously. But personally, the scary part, the part that I'm going to get, you know, 700 of those hours in, and I realize it's not working, it's not going to work, that really inhibits me. I have a devil on my shoulder. He just lives there and whispers in my ear, you are never going to make it to the end. This is going to not make any sense. It's going to be incoherent. You're never gonna herd these cats, and I hate that devil. I hate that guy, and that's the hardest part for me.
So, Jamie, you have techniques for dealing with what comes next. What are your techniques for dealing with that devil on your shoulder?
Crying.
Good. That's a good standby for me.
I have to. It's a fight. It's a wrestle. That's what I end up doing. I just have to try to elbow it away and even get 10 more minutes of work out. Occasionally, it is just about walking away and distracting myself. And unfortunately, that's really easy for me. So I fall down the rabbit hole of other things that interest me. And it's a tangly warren, but yeah, sometimes just getting away from it is the thing. And then the next time something good comes up, either a good concept or a good line or phrase, I give the devil the finger and keep going for a while.
If it's any consolation, you are not alone. In a recent interview, I spoke with Jerry B. Jenkins, who wrote the Left Behind series, which has sold like 70 million books. And, but
yeah,
over the course of his career, he's written 185 books. And so I was just astonished by this. And so I had asked him something about writing, and he said, yeah, when I hit a tough spot, I'll go and look at, you know, my bookshelf and be reminded, oh, yes, I can finish a book. I mean, he's written nearly 200 books, but he goes through the exact same thing that we go through, like, man, I don't know if I can finish this thing, you know?
That's
you
both heartening
that
and horrifying, because, you think that would go away.
Yeah.
Right, right. Wow.
Well, and I tell struggling authors that all the time, that most of us still struggle. No matter how many books we've done or how long we've been doing it, we still struggle. And a lot of them find that hard to believe, whether they don't believe it or they just don't want to believe it. But I think it's a pretty common ailment among all writers.
I do. And you know what else, too, is when these sorts of topics come up, I do say you can't expect – every job has its downside. And this is a job. And you can't expect it. People think if you work in the arts, you know, it's just – deep and rich and meaningful, and they might have this romantic image of the, you know, the gnashing teeth artist, but there is a mechanics, there's a practical thing that has to get done in order to do this, and every job has that. So as much as it's annoying that and it's frustrating, and sometimes, like I said, I cry, everybody has things that grinds their teeth about their jobs. And so you can't expect it not to have that. And so when I talk to people, I mean, yeah, I'm definitely not 14 books in. I'm working on number 3. But that's one of the points I make, too, is that this is one practical problem, and that's one of the things that is your own thing that you have to work on. And that's the thing that you're going to complain about at the end of the day. And somebody with a different kind of job, you know, a doctor, a guy who runs a restaurant, you know, an accountant, anybody, at the end of the day, they're going to have things to complain about, and this is what we have to complain about.
I don't know if it's this way for you guys, but sometimes I will hear or see. A lot of times it's interesting because I tend to write pretty visually. Like, I'm not as much of a wordsmith. I'm much more of the natural storyteller, right? So I have to really work to get the right words. But sometimes I hear dialogue first. Like, I'll hear maybe a conversation, and I'll write it down. I don't know who's speaking or even where they are or even what they want out of this conversation, but I just hear this conversation, and then that kind of leads me then into eventually visualizing the scene. But sometimes it just comes with, you know, a bit of dialogue or an exchange that really does resonate with the viewpoint or the voice of this character. And so I was thinking of one book that I'm working on, and the first line just starts out, it says, "My mommy and daddy, they hurt people." And wow. It's like, we don't know how old this child is, but already it's a little chilling. Like, we don't know exactly how they hurt people, but there's an essence of voice and viewpoint that are sort of melded together there. I think that voice and viewpoint are pretty hard to separate. And I know, Grant, we were talking earlier that that you kind of have this perspective on the idea of viewpoint and kind of how it relates to writing, a little bit of how it maybe relates to this stuff we've been talking about, voice and stuff. But I remember the face mask illustration. Now, I was wondering if you could remind us of the face mask and how that affects the way that you teach, you know, aspiring writers.
Sure. You know, one of the topics when I teach at Mastercraft Fest, especially one of the topics I talk about is extraordinary character, and I give them the idea of the scuba mask, actually, that every character wears, and the reader is experiencing the story through that particular character, and that particular character's scuba mask, and based on their background, their experiences, their morals, their wounds, whatever it might be, that mask is scratched in some places, it's cracked in others, it's very clear in others, it's discolored. So everything that comes into them through that mask is colored by the baggage they come into the story with. And if you can put the reader in that seat where they're seeing the story through that mask, I think it becomes more powerful for the reader.
I think that's good. I remembered that, and I called it face mask instead of scuba mask, but I like how the dings and the dents and the, you know, in affect the way that person sees the story. Jamie, when you write, when you kind of enter a character's perspective or point of view, whatever you want to call it, do you kind of naturally start to see through their cracks and dings, or are you consciously aware of that? How does that work for you when you develop these characters?
Well, I like what Grant said about that too, because it helps the people differentiate on the page. I mean, you can say I need this guy to do this and that, but how they're going to do it and how they're going to feel about what they're doing is definitely going to automatically come out in the words you choose for them because of their worldview. And I like that's kind of a faraway word to use. The scuba mask is a great accessible image. So yeah, I guess I kind of do that. I try to think about what are they mad about? What are they happy about? What's something that if they weren't doing what I was having them do at the moment, what would they rather be doing? And all of these things will inform that character and inform what they say and what they do and how they linger or struggle or fly out of the scene. So that's one of the things, and I'm sure that the scuba mask is going to stay with me because that is a nice accessible way to see it, because it is fun. I just saw Steven Pinker say something amazing, and he's a psychologist at Harvard, and he had said that fiction is an empathy technology, and I absolutely loved that, because I always have said that fiction is empathy exercise. It's like going to the gym and putting a weight over your head 20 times is completely pointless. There is no reason in the world to launch 20 pounds in the air 10 times, except that you're conditioning muscles that you might use elsewhere in something more practical. And I think fiction exercises our empathy, and it also writes the fiction. Empathy also writes the fiction. So you go into it seeing their worldview and trying it on.
You know, one of the techniques I really enjoy, but I don't use it a lot sometimes in action thrillers because characters aren't as deep in those kind of books, but, you know, asking what does a character want, and then asking, well, what do they tell people why they want this, and what's the real reason why they want this? Because we all have those fictions that we tell people, I want to run a marathon because, you know, it's an accomplishment. But there might be a real reason behind the stated reason. And that's often powerful to kind of dig into a character.
That's really interesting because the story that I'm working on right now has two guys who, the two main characters, have both separately survived astounding, bizarre things. We have one guy narrowly misses being the last victim of a famous serial killer, and the other guy had survived a bear attack inside his sister's house. This is based on a news story I read 1,000 years ago. But, yeah, what shapes them is this secret way that they feel about these incredible, ridiculous scenarios that they survived. And it really helps to think about what's the public face, what's their private face. It gives you a whole nother, buffet to draw from, and it makes things much more interesting.
Yeah, I think of three sort of degrees of desire, I guess, or I don't know, realms of it or something, but you have actual desire, perceived desire, and then expressed desire. And so, you know, a character comes into the back room of the bar and they say, what, you know, they're playing cards back there. The guy looks up, he's like, what do you want? He's like, I want to get in and play the game. Well, that's what his expressed desire, but he might have a completely, you know, different desire, right? Maybe he is trying to get in the game so that he can save the girl they've abducted or whatever it is. But maybe there's even a deeper thing he's not aware of, and I think this is what you're talking about, Grant. Like, maybe there's an actual desire that he doesn't realize yet, that he's in love with this girl. And he doesn't just want to save her. But so you have these three levels of desire, and I think sometimes you can allow the readers to become aware of the actual desire of a character before the character does, so that the readers are like, oh, he's really in love with her, but he doesn't realize it yet. And then they can sort of see his journey toward that revelation of his actual desire. And I kind of like that dynamic of understanding the three desires, both from the reader's perspective and the character's perspective, and allowing the character, or I mean the reader, to be in a different place in order to accomplish a different thing in that scene.
Do you two think, and I do the same thing, Stephen, I have, you know, a different way of explaining it, but I do the same thing, and I think even if I end up not using the, you know, the deeper why question and answer sessions I get from these characters, I think it tends to infuse the way the character plays on the page.
Oh, yeah.
If it's not stated, do you guys agree?
Absolutely. I think there's things that you know that you never put on the page, and that can go from practicalities that you discover in research all the way to emotional things. Like, for some reason, the characters I'm writing now, I know a lot of their weird backstories that will never make it onto the page. It doesn't need to. It would be silly, but it absolutely informs what they do and how they've come to this place. And I think it's one of the most rewarding things to be able to make something out of these daydreams, because it's great fun, and it's a privilege to be able to do it, to get it on the page. And they definitely have a lot more. It's I guess the old cliche iceberg mode, you know.
Right. With the, you know, we just see the glimpse and stuff. And sometimes at when I'm teaching writing, I'll give people this assignment to, I don't even know where I heard this years ago, but I like the idea. So whoever came up with this, write to me and I'll credit you. But to write a letter to you from the character, right? And so, in other words, like, I would sit down and say, okay, in the next 4 minutes or five, whatever, write a letter from Patrick Bowers, let's say, from one of my suspense novels, to you. But this is how it starts. You've never really understood me. What I really want is ... That's how you start the letter. And then, you know, I just say, okay, right now, 4 minutes, go ahead and write a paragraph. And it is astonishing. At the end of the 4 minutes, I'll look around and I'll say, did you learn anything about this character? And literally everyone is like, yes, I had no idea before. Isn't that crazy, though?
That's really cool. And you know what? I've not heard that exercise, and I love it. One of the last things I do when revising a work and finishing it up, after I've been through it several times, what would be really interesting for me is to have those characters, you know, a couple of the main players, write me a letter, because one of the last steps I take is putting my chapter numbers in a hat and pulling them out and revising completely out of order. And it's amazing what opportunities show up to foreshadow or deepen something or add a little twist or nuance there. But if you had just done that exercise and then revised out of order, that might be amazing. Mm-hmm. I know what I'm doing at the end of my new book.
You know,
I like this revise out of order. That's a good idea. Oh, go ahead, Greg.
Oh, it's helpful.
Well, I like both of them. I like the asymmetrical rewriting. But, Stephen, I have to tell you, my students at Thriller Fest this year, at Master Craft Fest, they're going to be angry with you because I'm going to be keeping them longer doing the letter writing exercise. So when they complain to you, that's why.
Oh, yeah. You know, this year, my daughter's getting married this summer. I don't know if you guys knew that or not, but I'm not actually going to make it up. I think this will be the first time in like 8 years where I won't make it up to Thriller Fest this summer. I've always enjoyed it, and I look forward to coming back. But, my daughter's getting married, so I was like, all right.
That would be a pretty hard sell. Sorry, honey,
you know,
I can't make your wedding.
So,
I gotta...
So, but these are good. See, what I like about sort of some of this idea, writing out of order, or analyzing it, or the letters from the characters. I mean, they're very practical and simple and small tools. It isn't like you have to spend 10 hours or 100 hours or something like that. Instead, I love the practicality of some of these little activities that we can do to really give us the fresh perspective that so much of the story depends on.
You know, there is software out there that will do that to you. I think I have this application that you start a timer and you start writing, and if you stop writing for more than 5 seconds, everything you've written will be erased.
I think I've heard of that.
Yes.
Do you use it?
I don't use it for anything important.
I would jump out a window. I don't think I'd last very long on that. But I can see where some people could, for sure. But I can't write like that. I think I'd have a heart attack.
Yeah, I feel enough pressure already. I don't need to add any more pressure.
Yeah,
but you know, it's amazing how many different ways to do it.
Do we really need any help being more neurotic as writers?
Yeah, there you go. That's a good question, exactly. When I was thinking about the interview today, I was looking through some notes, and I found a quote from Kurt Vonnegut that just relates this idea of style and voice distinctiveness, and it says, "Find a subject you care about and which you, in your heart, feel others should care about. It is this genuine caring and not your games or language which will be your most compelling and seductive element in your style." And I think that passion to, you know, to capture something that is vital within us, I truly think that if someone is being entertained and they can sense that this is a story that matters, they'll forgive a lot of plot blunders or whatever it might be, that they sense that there's this energy and passion and distinctiveness about this story or this writing that they just can't put it down. I mean, and then, you know, maybe some plot thing, they'll say, okay, whatever, I just forgive you because I'm enjoying it so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, coming from Kurt Vonnegut, who plays wonderful games with language, that's a really powerful statement.
Yeah. I mean...
it is.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, it is powerful because I'm a huge Vonnegut fan, and it's interesting to hear him say that. Except that when you really think about it, it makes perfect sense that can't be the reason you're doing it, that you just wanted to play with the language. You wanted to play with the language because there was something important or that you wanted to seem important, even if only for a few moments in somebody's mind. You strike a little match in there to think about this for a second. And that's wonderful. I love that quote.
I think that... that's sometimes this idea with people trying to be literary or you know what I mean, or trying to be funny or trying to be impressive or trying to be eloquent. And none of that ever works, really. It's just, is it authentic? Like when you're reading something and you can sort of sense that the author's trying to show off his dictionary knowledge or whatever, none of that really impresses us. We just want this authentic, you know, story. And if the character who's telling it isn't articulate or whatever, we accept it as long as it remains authentic. I think that's, you know, that's one of the keys. I was working on this book called Troubleshooting Your Novel, and I had this idea, this one line, "I ain't never killed nobody before." And I was like, oh, that's really interesting to me. I ain't never killed nobody before. But I was like, I couldn't write that book. Like, I couldn't stay in that voice for the whole book. I'm not a good enough writer to do that. You know what I'm saying?
Immersion is that. That's what that is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, yeah, I mean, it's just this interesting, you know, kind of voice. I ain't never killed nobody before, but, you know, I can maybe make it a paragraph, but after that I'm like, I just couldn't carry that through, and it would seem striving. It would be
dangerous to try. I think that, you know, when you write in dialect, or if you write in an interesting, you know, if someone has an interesting speech pattern, even in their thoughts, it is so easy to get carried away, and it will become onerous. You know, there are people who have made it work, and they can drag a shtick like that through a whole novel, I don't think I could do it.
Yeah.
I feel the same way about John Updike. His style is, he makes it work, but I think if I tried to write in Updike's style, it would be a horrendous mistake. he makes it work somehow.
Finding your distinctiveness, being authentic in your stories, and I can't believe we've been talking for 40 minutes already. It's really good conversation. So, Jamie, tell us a little bit about your book, Monday's Lie. What drew you to this story? What was it that really drew you to tell this specific story?
This one was really interesting because it came together from a lot of little pieces. And one of the most fun things for me about even trying to write books is that it makes what happens in my life, nothing is wasted. So long, in fact, it was Killer Nashville, but it was a long time ago, maybe 2009, 2008. I saw a man who was with the TBI, but he was on loan, I believe it was with the FBI, in a task force about fugitive apprehension. That's what they were working on. And he was telling us in an aside about developing, how they were trying to develop facial recognition technology and why it was tricky because human beings process human faces very interestingly. You can see it in functional MRIs. Every cognitively normal person processes faces the exact same way, top down, left to right. Doesn't matter if you're right or left-handed, you never reverse it, top down, left to right, and that's how we load faces in. And when we see someone we haven't seen in a reasonable amount of time, your brain apparently actually shuffles every face you've ever seen and sorts it, everyone you've taken note of, and sorts it incredibly quickly. And they couldn't duplicate this with that speed in facial recognition technology, which has probably come a long way in the last 8 years or so. But one thing they discovered by accident was that if you turned a photo upside down and you loaded the person into your mind, chin to forehead, right to left, because necessarily everything was reversed, that when you saw that, when you were presented with that face again, right side up, you would instantly recall everything that you knew about this person. It wouldn't matter what they did to disguise themselves. This is what was really interesting for the facial recognition and the task force that was fugitive apprehension. So as soon as I hear this, that if you load a face into your head upside down, that you'll remember. It doesn't matter if they age or change their appearance, their hair, sunglasses, hat, whatever, you will recognize them instantly. I said, well, that's got to go in a book. And then I thought it would be very interesting to have a spy story, but not – we have lots of people who nobody knows is a spy. They just live on your street, a nice suburban thing. But what if it was that person's kid? Like, if that was your mom who was the spy, if you were the child of this, would that be very strange if this is the way you grew up with not really knowing what your mom did, but you kind of knew? And so these elements came together as a story about a woman whose mother was a black ops asset, and she really hated the black Bentleys driving up in the night and dropping stuff off. And her mother was actually effortlessly maternal and a complete badass all at the same time, and I didn't know if that was possible. And I also wanted to write a character who was actually dead in actuality during the action of the book, but very, very alive in memory. And so Annette Vest, the mother, the black ops asset, is actually not alive during the main action of the story, but in memory she's so vivid that she's almost the main character. You could make that argument. So it was just a little cobbled together out of little pieces.
I think that's how so many stories that end up resonating kind of come together for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree.
I mean, you know, you have this one, oh, that's a really interesting, research. And it is. It's intriguing. And then you have this other character and this bit of dialogue and this conflict. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you start, it'd be interesting if this,
And then the first thing that came to me for this book when I actually started putting it all together was a line. It was interesting when you said sometimes you just get a bit of dialogue. I have a tendency to get one line, and I think, okay, what is the story around this line? And the line was, my mother told me never to keep a man for more years than you could count on your fingers. And the joke is that the woman is actually missing two fingers from her left hand. That becomes part of the story. But what was super funny about that, that used to be the opening line of the book. It's now a few pages in. But my husband is my first reader, and so my mother told me never to keep a man for more years than you could count on your fingers. And my husband said, "Did your mom really say this?" I'm like, "No, honey, I just make stuff up."
That's what I do. That's what I do for
That's
a living.
That's what I do. Yeah.
It's all day long. I just make stuff up.
Well, this has been really great conversation. I really like the thoughts about voice, about viewpoint, about how we, it's just the creative process and the idea of trusting the movement of, you know, our imagination in the direction of a story. And so Jamie, thanks for being on. Where should people go to check out your newest book, or to maybe order or see maybe where you might be appearing to speak?
Well, I have a website, which is jamie-mason.com, because another Jamie Mason is a realtor in Baltimore, and she got the good website. So jamie-mason.com. And yeah, everything's there, so that would be great. Thank you.
Yeah, and Grant, what about you this summer? Do you have another book coming out?
Yeah, I have another Jack Ryan Jr. campus book, though in this book he's actually on leave of absence from the campus, and it comes out June 14th, and it's called Duty and Honor.
Excellent. Duty and Honor. Good. Mm-hmm. For information about my writing, you can go to stephenjames.net, or novelwritingintensive.com has information about my next institute, next retreat. And, of course, for more info about our guests and other broadcasts, click to the storyblender.com. And always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.